ABCs of NMOSD is an education podcast series to share knowledge about neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, or NMOSD, a rare relapsing autoimmune disorder that preferentially causes inflammation in the optic nerves and spinal cord. ABCs of NMOSD is hosted by SRNA, the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association, and in collaboration with the Sumaira Foundation and Guthy Jackson Charitable Foundation. This education series is made possible through a patient education grant from Amgen.
Hello and welcome to the ABCs of NMOSD podcast series. Today's podcast is titled Transitioning from Pediatric to Adult Care with NMOSD. My name is Chrissy Dilger, and I moderated this podcast. SRNA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at wearesrna.org. For this podcast, we were pleased to be joined by Dr. Jonathan Galley. Dr. Galley is a neurologist at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah. You can view his full bio in the podcast description. So welcome and thank you for joining me today. Can you begin by just briefly giving an overview of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. So neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, or shortened to NMOSD, has, I'd say, historically kind of fallen into several different kind of areas of characterization or families of diseases, if you will. Actually, historically was thought to be an MS variant way back in the day, which we know certainly isn't the case now. But really, kind of at its core, NMOSD falls into the syndromes that are mediated most classically by the presence of the aquaporin 4 antibody, which actually causes damage to supportive cells in the central nervous system called the astrocytes. And then there's some downstream immunological effects that damages most often the optic nerves. So the nerves that take information from the eyes back into the brain or the spinal cord. In rare cases, it can affect the brain as well, but typically we think of it as primarily optic nerves or spinal cord. Kind of most recently within the field, there's also generally the idea of what we call seronegative NMOSD, which are patients who meet specific diagnostic criteria with optic nerve, spinal cord involvement, but don't have the presence of the aquaporin 4 antibody. There's a little bit of debate within the field, but generally we think of, you know, seronegative NMO as a similar-ish disease entity in some ways as patients with aquaporin 4, although there are some differences that we aren't going to get too far into today.
Okay, great. Thank you. So today we're talking about, you know, pediatric transitioning into adulthood with NMOSD. So just to start us off on that topic, are there differences in how pediatric and adult NMOSD present?
Yeah, it's a great question. In general, you can still see some of our classic presentations, and that includes optic neuritis. And typically it's bilateral or both optic nerves being affected. You can also see, again, spinal cord involvement, and typically that's what we call longitudinally extensive. So those are longer spinal cord lesions than, say, those that we see with patients with multiple sclerosis. Both the bilateral optic neuritis and transverse myelitis are presentations that we can see in our pediatric populations. Interestingly, though, the pediatric population there have been more cases reported of both hypothalamic involvement, where patients will have inflammatory damage to their hypothalamus, which can actually cause issues with hormones, hormone productions that we'll call endocrinopathies. And they do, our pediatric patients do tend to have a little bit more what we call cerebral involvement. So involvement of the actual brain itself rather than just optic nerves or spinal cord. You can see brainstem involvement in adults, but it does seem to be a little bit more prevalent in kids. And adults typically will see what we call area postrema syndrome, where the area postrema specifically has inflammatory damage. Kids can also have brainstem involvement. So certainly we can see the same kind of presentation in pediatric patients that we see with adults, but a little bit more broad range of presentation.
Got it. And in a similar vein, are there differences in how pediatric and adult NMOSD are treated?
Yeah. So in adults and children, I think the big take-home point, regardless of pediatric versus adult, is aggressive therapies up front are incredibly important. And so in the pediatric population, I would still recommend aggressive treatment. So in some ways, the treatment is very similar. So the typical recommendation for treatment in patients is high-dose IV steroids, usually for 3, I prefer 5 days. And then most of the time, we will also implement plasmapheresis or plasma exchange in patients, because we know that that NMOSD is an aggressive disease, and that left, you know, inadequately treated, you can still have a lot of long-term disability. I tend to recommend aggressive treatment with at least steroids and plasmapheresis. We know that in children, plasmapheresis is very safe, even down into young ages. So I would say for the most part, in the acute setting, they're relatively similar. As far as maintenance treatment, the mainstay of treatment in the long term is what we call steroid-sparing treatment, where we're having patients on immunosuppressive medications to decrease the immune response and therefore decrease the risk of relapse. I'd say the biggest difference at this point is several of the newer FDA-approved medications, at least for seropositive, aquaporin-4-mediated NMOSD, those are still in trials for pediatric populations, whereas in adults, we have several FDA-approved medications. That being said, I wouldn't say that's, you know, a dismal thing for our pediatric patients. We still have several medications that we use off-label. The most common one, I'd say, in our clinic for our under 18 patients is probably rituximab, which is a CD20 inhibiting medication. I also use that most commonly in my adult patients, just because it's not been proven to be less effective than some of these other newer medications at this point. So for me, most of my patients, whether you're 15, whether you're 35, shoot, whether you're 60, I probably would tend more towards starting patients on rituximab anyways, personally. So there's a few nuancy differences, but I think for the most part, we're able to manage patients pretty well, whether they're on the pediatric side or adult, both in the acute and the longer term phase.
Got it. Thank you. So for someone who is diagnosed with NMOSD as a child, are there any concerns about effects of the disorder on development or effects of the medications?
It's a great question. So potentially, depending on where the lesion occurs, it's there could be some long-term, you know, trouble with mobility, ambulation or walking, things along those lines, especially if there's a longitudinally extensive spinal cord lesion that can lead to longer term trouble with things along those lines. Same if there's optic neuritis, you can have long-term visual impairment. again, kind of depending on how you respond to the acute therapies. But other than that, it's nothing that would really change, you know, cognitive development, you know, other development, anything along those lines. As far as the treatments are concerned, with any immune therapy, you know, there's the concern about potential increased infectious risk, slight increase in bloodborne malignancies and things along those lines. But really, even the medications themselves really shouldn't cause any significant developmental concerns in our patients.
Got it. Good to know. So for a child with NMOSD who is in their teens and nearing adulthood, what are some of the ways in which they can start preparing for that transition? Are there any tools you use in your clinic to help children and their families with the process?
Yeah, it's a great question. So our institution, we have a pretty interesting model where our pediatric patients are seen in one medical system, and then our medical system is a separate one on the adult side. So our colleagues that are seeing our patients with either MOG, even MS, they're the ones that are oftentimes transitioning to us. What we're working on right now is actually kind of a intermediate clinic where our pediatric provider will come over to the adult clinic physically, see their patient one last time, have one of us, the adult providers, meet and greet with the patient, and then basically do a gentle handoff in the adult side. So it's kind of an overlap type model. The discussion occurs initially on the pediatric side with our pediatric providers, where they start actually having the discussion as our patients move into kind of the adolescent age, where they start talking about the transition of clinics and things like that, so that, you know, patients aren't just caught unaware of making that transition. I think as far as patients who are in their teens, I think as you start to get closer to the magical age of 18, where all the transition really happens, and suddenly you go from the pediatric side and then are all of a sudden considered an adult, I think the biggest thing that you can do is make sure that you just talk with your current pediatric neurologist about what does this look like? Who's taking care of me once I hit 18? Will that continue to be you? Am I going to transition to the adult side? If I do that, what does that look like? So I think having that conversation around the age of 15, 16, just so that you're aware and you're not, again, caught, you know, all of a sudden being like, well, I'll see you later, I think is probably the best thing to do. And then also having that conversation with family, you know, not to get too far into logistics, I think from a, you know, maybe not necessarily on our adolescent patients, but certainly for families, is thinking about what does insurance look like for me. Certainly if there's a two-system model like we have, you know, switching from the pediatric side over to the adult side isn't just like changing clinics. It could be actually change, you know, mean like changing insurance providers and things like that. So I think that's something for families to keep in mind as well, is do I need to look at my insurance options as well, so that doesn't end up being a big hang up.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. So just talking more about this transition process in your clinic. So you kind of said that 15, 16 is when the process starts. What can you tell us more about the timeline? Like at 18, is that the hard line or is it kind of gradual? What's the timeline for the transition?
It's a great question. To be honest, there's no hard and fast. I've had a couple patients transition over around 15 or 16. And this was kind of prior to us having a little bit more standardized model. Dr. Melissa Wright is our pediatric neurologist who's autoimmune trained, who's kind of pioneering things from the pediatric side. And she, and when we discussed this last, it's kind of around this age, 16, 17. I'm sure if somebody wasn't quite ready, she'd wait. Knowing her, she's not going to rush to get anybody out. But the, I'd say 16 to 18 is probably around the typical age where we'll start at least having the conversation. And then probably 17, 18 is around when we'll have them come over to that transition clinic over on the university side. That being said, it's a lot of times it comes down to the comfort of the pediatric neurologist of what age they want to treat up till, which, you know, ours are, I think, very comfortable treating to 18 and a little bit beyond. Part of it comes down to the comfort as well as the adult neurologist of what age they're comfortable treating. You know, I have a couple of patients who are, you know, 14 to 15 that I'm very comfortable treating. So like for me, it's very much comfortable. If they just came straight over at that age, that'd be fine as well. So really it's kind of more a readiness from the patient and family, I think, that helps guide that a little bit. And then as far as kind of what the process looks like, you know, the support staff on the pediatric side make sure the patient's scheduled over at the adult side clinic. They'll see Dr. Wright, and then again, we'll do kind of the meet and greet. And then on our end of things, we have clinic nurses who are very involved in our patient care that oftentimes will help kind of coordinate the family conversation and the move over to the adult side as well. And certainly one of the first things that we'll address with family is like what needs do we need to meet kind of in the immediacy of changing over? Because obviously it's a big transition for everybody. So
yeah, for sure. And you mentioned support staff that helps with that transition. That was another one of the questions I was going to ask, is just like the role of social workers or nurses. What place do they have in this transition? How long will they stick with that patient before, you know, letting them loose? What in your clinic, can you speak to that experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, it's probably clinic dependent on what staff are available and kind of what their roles are. At least for our clinic, our nursing staff are very, very involved with patient care. You know, whether I can tell you whether you're a new, you know, young adult patient, or if you're just that we're transitioning over from the pediatric side, or if you're a adult with a new diagnosis of something, our nursing staff is still very involved either way. And really they stay integral in the kind of patient care experience all along. I mean, our nursing staff is incredibly important and integral, where a lot of times they're the ones that are triaging our messaging inbox, taking calls and things like that, where they may be the point person that our patients are talking with a little bit more even than our providers. And again, that's not something that typically goes away. I always joke with my patients that my clinic nurse, Tracy's the real superstar, that they'll oftentimes still like her more than me in the long run. So it is something that I think is really important and integral to that first meeting, where you get to meet the staff that you're going to be working with in the long term, get a chance to know them, get comfortable with them. You know, we don't have a huge social work involvement in this specific process. It's certainly something that I think can be beneficial. Again, I think that need oftentimes is met by our nursing staff more than anybody.
Awesome. And obviously it's a transition for your clinic from a totally different, basically, centers. So your care team will have a lot of changes. So your neurologist will change. Any other, I guess, care team differences or changes that happen between pediatric and adult? Are there anybody that a pediatric patient may need to start seeing or may not need to see anymore now that they're an adult?
Yeah, it's a good question. So like you said, certainly kind of new faces show up across the board, you know, even as simple as like, you know, new nursing staff, you'll have new medical assistants in the clinic, new phlebotomists in the clinic that, you know, you may have gotten used to staff for years and years in the pediatric side and everyone's new. The, you know, even down to you know, pharmacy and things along those lines. Generally, I think, at least in our clinic, I think the biggest thing is just making sure that our patients are meeting, especially the individuals who they're going to be, you know, communicating with a lot. You know, part of the transition as well into the adult world oftentimes sees our patients becoming more independent, and potentially parents aren't going to be there as much as a part of their visits. So that's the other thing that, you know, finding as we're making this transition is not necessarily just in that specific example, but, you know, kind of saying, all right, now that we're entering the adult side, what needs do you have? Because they certainly can be different from the pediatric side where, you know, we don't necessarily have the same support staff to help with like things like school and things along those lines. We have more kind of social work, support staff, things like that, that may focus more on like, you know, what does employment look like? What is, you know, moving forward into the adult world look like and things like that. So certainly can be a big shift. And I think the biggest way to make that a success is really just meeting everybody involved early on and just being comfortable with them in that transition.
Yeah, that's important. Definitely. So after transitioning into adult care, what are the things that you as a neurologist have to kind of evaluate and take stock of? For instance, are there things like medication dosages that change or are reevaluated? Anything like that?
Yeah, for sure. So anytime I'm transitioning any patient, I'll always take a look at their medications just to make sure that, you know, we're all on the same page. Certainly medication dosing can change, you know, in the pediatric side, oftentimes medications are weight-based, especially at younger ages now. In the adolescent to kind of young adult population, generally it's a little more straightforward. I remember trying to do math back in my pediatric neurology rotations and I brought my calculator along with me at times because it racked my brain a little bit. So certainly, you know, one of the things that I'll look at is to make sure that from an immunotherapy standpoint, dosing is okay. Make sure that I'm in agreement with the current dosing current immune therapy that the patient's on. And then even something as simple as symptomatic medications, I'll take a look at the dosing and make sure that we're on an adequate enough dose, you know, and just make sure that we're not actually underdosing medications. Generally, when patients are transitioning over, they're already on really appropriate immune therapy. So I don't actually have to spend a ton of time reinventing that wheel. We're very lucky that we have a fantastic pediatric neurology group over at Primary Children's. And you know, to be honest, I don't worry too much when they come on over that we're on the wrong medications or we have to redo anything. Really what I'll spend the most time checking in with is what are your immediate needs from a symptomatic standpoint? Like what can we do to really kind of keep the ball rolling, really with the goal of, you know, what can we do to get you feeling your best, to get you functioning your best despite having this condition? So that's honestly when I'm transitioning patients over where I will focus the most is like, is there something missing in your medication regimen that would really make your life easier?
Got it. Thank you. Are there differences in the frequency of appointments with neurologists once a person with NMOSD becomes an adult?
I don't necessarily think so. I think most patients see their neurologist about every 6 months or so. Certainly in younger pediatric patients, it would be reasonable to see them or in somebody early in the course of their diagnosis. Sometimes we'll do, every 3 month visits, things along those lines, which I personally will still do in somebody if it's really necessary, especially from like a symptomatic management standpoint. I don't think, from our standpoint, at least it's something that, you go to the adult side and you get ignored or forgotten about. I think it's pretty much the same frequency that you get in with.
Got it. Well, thank you so much for answering all of our questions about this topic. I guess to lead us off, is there any advice or tidbits of information you would like to share with children or their families who are transitioning into adult care?
Yeah, for sure. So I think my biggest piece of advice, and I think this is probably advice that a lot of patients I've just heard at some point along the lines of just advocating for yourself. I think, within that, I think the biggest thing you can do is, again, kind of once you start hitting that adolescent period where you're like, I'm going to be an adult in a couple of years, just having that conversation with what does the future look like for me when I hit 18, so that you're allowed to get prepared for that. And I think really the biggest thing is, while the pediatric world can be a little different than the adult world, I would not be scared to make a transition over to the adult side. I mean, I can tell you, we all love our adult, obviously our adolescent patients, but we love our adult patients and enjoy taking care of them. And I think, it's, while it can be a big jump in all new faces, I think, everybody that's on the adult side is excited for it as well. And I think we all take a lot of joy in kind of taking over. And as exciting as, your teenagers are, it's, I think for me personally, one of my most rewarding things about taking care of a younger population of patients is really watching my patients kind of grow up into young adulthood. And it's something I truly enjoy. So I think, again, making sure that you advocate for yourself, always very important. And shoot, I'd say that in someone who's 10 years old up to 85. So always important, but also just, don't, it's not something you should be scared of. Be informed. Make sure that, if you are looking at providers, trying to find reviews and things on, if a provider is more comfortable with younger patients or in this transition period, doing that, I think is really important as well, just to make sure, again, just to reiterate, making sure, I think the most important thing is finding a knowledgeable provider, but one that you're also comfortable with is important.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. That's all I have for this podcast, but we really appreciate your time and you joining us today.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to our ABCs of NMOSD podcast series sponsor, Amgen. Amgen is focused on the discovery, development, and commercialization of medicines that address critical needs for people impacted by rare, autoimmune, and severe inflammatory diseases. They apply scientific expertise and courage to bring clinically meaningful therapies to patients. Amgen believes science and compassion must work together to transform lives.